Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Newman, a host of this channel. Today, I'm speaking with Alberto Garcia about his new book, Abandoning Their Beloved Land, The Politics of Bracero Migration in Mexico. This book was published by the University of California Press in 2023. Alberto Garcia is Assistant Professor of History at San Jose State University. Alberto, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the program.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you for inviting me. Happy to be here today.
Let's begin by hearing about how you came to write this book about braceros and how you chose to emphasize the Bajío, a central western region of Mexico that features in many of the chapters.
Yeah, well, this began as a very personal story for me, and it is still a personal story. I'm the grandson of a bracero. My maternal grandfather was a bracero. He was one of the first people to leave as a bracero from my family's hometown of Changuitiro. That's Changuitiro, just in case if anyone is interested about the spelling, which is a rural community in northern Michoacán. And he's not the only male relative of mine or male ancestor of mine who was a bracero. One of my dad's older brothers was a bracero. I have numerous great uncles who were braceros as well. And so, you know, part of, my first entry into this, or the thing that interested me, is, you know, I come from an immigrant family. I come from a bracero sending family. One of the reasons why I focused on the Bajío, and this is that region is in central western Mexico. It's the contiguous lands of southern Guanajuato, northern Michoacán, northeastern Jalisco, southwestern Aguascalientes, and southern Zacatecas. So central western Mexico to the north and to the west of Mexico City. Historically, this is a relatively temperate region of Mexico. It's also relatively flat. And at least since the emergence of the silver economy during the colonial period, this has been one of Mexico's breadbasket regions. And so a lot of grain and livestock producing estates that have supplied, whether it was the silver mines of Guanajuato and Zacatecas, but also Mexico City as well. And one of the reasons why I focus on this region is because I grew up in the Sacramento region in California, grew up in a small town there. A town that had an increasingly growing Mexican population during the 1980s and during the 1990s. And the overwhelming majority of the Mexican families in the town that I grew up in were from this region of Mexico. So their families from northern Michoacán, like my family, or families from southern Guanajuato, families from northeastern Jalisco, families from southern Zacatecas. And many of my childhood friends growing up, their family backgrounds were similar to mine as well. So they had grandfathers who were braceros, or they had older uncles or great uncles who had spent time in the United States, particularly in California, working as braceros. So that personal connection was my entryway into the story. And so there was that personal connection. And then that personal connection, though, led to my initial research question when I began this project as a graduate student at UC Berkeley, because this book is a revised version of my dissertation. Prior to the years of the Bracero program, and the Bracero program, which was a guest worker initiative that allowed, I should have explained this earlier, I apologize. It was a guest worker initiative that allowed Mexican men to work in the United States as seasonal contract farm workers, and they were referred to as braceros. And the program was in effect from 1942 until 1964. But prior to braceros leaving my family's hometown in Mexico, my family's hometown was involved in the religious political violence of the 1920s and the 1930s, specifically the Cristero War, this movement of conservative Catholic partisans who opposed official anti-clericalism, opposed land redistribution, opposed secular public education. They mobilized against the revolutionary governments of the 1920s and the 1930s. And so, you know, I have grandfathers and great uncles who are braceros, but I have great grandparents, great great uncles, who fought in the Cristero War, who fought on both sides, who fought either as conservative Catholic partisans who opposed the government or who fought on behalf of the government. And again, you know, many of my childhood friends, they also had similar backgrounds as well. You know, they also had older male ancestors who had participated in the conflicts of the 1920s and the 1930s. And so then I thought to myself, well, is there a connection? Is there a connection? Did the religious political violence that shaped this region of Mexico in the 1920s and the 1930s, did that then shape the migratory tradition that really took root during the years of the Bracero program? And so that's, long story short, that's how I came to the project.
Your book makes a really provocative point early on that this migration of braceros, it wasn't only about socioeconomic questions or challenges, but that this is a migration that's also about politics, Mexican politics. So can you talk us through this idea before we start to get into the book's chapters?
Yeah. So what I found, I talk about this in the book. I mean, I don't discount socioeconomic factors such as, you know, low wages or unemployment or either complete lack of access to land or insufficient access to land as the proximate factors that influence individuals' decisions to migrate as braceros. And, you know, many of the braceros, you know, the wages that they earned in the U.S. as braceros, even though they're low within the context of the United States, they're higher than the wages they earned in Mexico. Many of them then did invest their earnings in Mexico as well. But what I found is that as I was doing my research, and this was research that, you know, took place in the National Archive of Mexico City, the AGN, also the state government archives of Michoacán, Guanajuato, Jalisco, Aguascalientes, local municipal archives as well. What I found is that often the socioeconomic marginalization that aspiring braceros cited in the letters where they explained why they were interested in migrating, there was an underlying political factor that caused it. So in other words, the socioeconomic marginalization didn't happen in a vacuum. It happened in very distinct political context, very distinct Mexican political context. And so what I found is, okay, yes, there would be aspiring braceros who say, well, I'm interested in migrating as a bracero because the only employment options that are available to me in my area, in my hometown, in my area are, you know, a day laborer, so no fixed employment. But the reason why day labor was prevalent in that region is because the local landowners had blocked the redistribution of lands to local rural workers in that region. Others who say, you know, I'm unemployed. Well, the reason that they were unemployed is because they had been blacklisted, either landowners who had different political leanings, had blacklisted them from employment. I also found in some regions where sugar was cultivated and where you had unionized sugar mills, organized sugar mills. So sugar mills where the workers belong to labor unions, labor disputes would lead to workers being blacklisted or being dismissed from their jobs. Many workers who said that they didn't have access to lands, they had been pushed off of their lands because of the ongoing religious political conflicts, which continued at the local level during the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s. So these local conflicts continued. And as a result, rural workers would be pushed off of their lands and they would begin consider migrating to the United States. Also with younger rural workers, younger braceros. So braceros who came of age during the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s. By this period in Mexico's history, the governments of the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s were more conservative governments, governments that did not prioritize the redistribution of lands in the same way that their counterparts in the 1920s and the 1930s had. So younger braceros, the reason they didn't have lands is because their petitions for redistributed lands were, you know, falling on, you know, they were just being ignored. They were being ignored by increasingly conservative officials who thought that land redistribution was something that was needed in the 1920s and the 1930s, but no longer needed, in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s. So there is this underlying, this very powerful underlying political dimension that conditioned the socioeconomic marginalization that braceros experienced in Mexico before they made the decision to migrate to the United States.
So let's see how this works throughout the chapters. So looking kind of at the book's first chapter, at the beginning of the bracero program, selection is in the hands of the Mexican federal government, but it doesn't end up staying that way. So why does decentralization start to happen? Can you talk us through how that worked?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, the federal governments of the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, like, and specifically the 1940s, because decentralization of the bracero selection process begins in the 1940s. The governments of the 1940s, like the governments of the 1930s and the 1920s, they prioritized the centralization of power. They wanted to build up federal power, build up the apparatus, the capabilities of the federal state. And so as part of the centralization effort, and also as part of a conclusion that the administration that initially agreed to participate in the Bracero program, this is the administration of Manuel Ávila Camacho, who was president from 1940 to 1946. One of their concerns when they agreed to the Bracero program is they were worried that the Bracero program would lead to undocumented migration from Mexico to the United States. In the decree where the president announced the agreement with the United States, the president actually referred to it as clandestine migration. And so Ávila Camacho's administration was willing to sanction migration to the United States, but they wanted to make sure that it happened within the parameters of the Bracero program. So as part of its overarching drive to centralize power, and as part of its desire to limit undocumented migration as much as possible, Ávila Camacho's administration made the decision that all braceros, regardless of where they lived in Mexico, would have to travel to Mexico City to be vetted there for their contracts. And again, you know, the federal government made the decision that this is what will ensure that nobody tries to enter the United States without a contract, without authorization. But it didn't work out that way. There were many who wanted to be braceros, who simply ignored the dictates of the federal government, begin entering the United States without authorization. And, you know, much like happens today, they found employers who were willing to hire them as undocumented workers. So you do have folks who just completely ignore the federal government's instructions. The other thing that happened is that the federal government didn't properly gauge how much interest there would be in migrating to the United States as a bracero. So what ends up happening is that Mexico City and the federal government established a contracting center at the National Stadium. And this is a stadium. It's no longer there. It was in the Roma neighborhood. So this is western Mexico City, or west of downtown in Mexico City. But there were so many people who went to Mexico City to try to get contracts that the personnel assigned to the National Stadium were overwhelmed. They couldn't keep up with the demand. There were also allegations from aspiring braceros that the personnel only worked for a few hours in the morning. And also there were allegations of widespread corruption at the contracting center. There were many officials who were found to be exchanging contracts for bribes. And so the corruption, the official corruption at the contracting center, combined with the inefficiency, with the federal personnel's inability to keep up with the number of people there, it basically made the neighborhood around the National Stadium into something of a powder keg. So you have aspiring braceros who end up sleeping on the streets near the National Stadium so that they can increase their likelihood to get in line early in the morning and get a contract. You have people who live in those neighborhoods beginning to complain about these aspiring braceros from rural Mexico, taking over the neighborhood, making it impossible for them to move around, to take their children to school in the mornings. And then the aspiring braceros themselves get increasingly frustrated with the inefficiency. They become increasingly frustrated with the corruption at the contracting center. And so in February 1944, there is a violent disturbance, a violent altercation that occurs at the National Stadium, because a group of aspiring braceros were able to cut the line because they had paid a bribe. So they cut the line. Everyone gets upset. The aspiring braceros try to force their way into the stadium. That leads to violence. That leads to some of the federal personnel at the contracting center drawing weapons and firing on the protesting crowd. And once that happens, the federal government basically realizes, okay, this did not work out. This didn't work out. People are ignoring our instructions and entering the U.S. as undocumented braceros. We've lost control at the National Stadium. So after the violence of February of early 1944, you begin to see recruitment and selection responsibilities delegated to state governments. And the only power that the federal government, at least in terms of the recruitment and selection of braceros, the only power that the federal government retained for itself was deciding how many contracts each state government would receive to distribute. And because popular demand for contracts was higher in the states of, in the Bajío states, so Aguascalientes, Guanajuato, Jalisco, Michoacán, Zacatecas, the plurality of the contracts were sent there. Anywhere between 40 and 50% of the contracts, it depended on the year. And this is a disproportionate share because only about 20% of Mexico's population lives in those states.
So when the state governments in the Bajío region take on the work of actually giving out these contracts, what do they imagine that this process is going to be like? How do they want to select people? And are they able to carry it out in the way that they plan?
The state governments they never wanted this responsibility. During my research, I never found any evidence that the state governments asked for the responsibility. So they are delegated a responsibility that they do not want, and they are concerned, they are afraid that they will lose control in the same way that the federal government did. Because almost immediately in 1944, when you see the first provincial recruitment and selection and contract distribution centers open in cities like Irapuato, that's a city in Guanajuato, in Zacatecas City, again, you know, you see many of the same problems that occurred in Mexico City, and that the demand, the interest in migrating is so high that the cities are overwhelmed. And you know, Guanajuato state government almost immediately is worried about inconvenient agglomerations and breakneck mobilizations of rural workers to Irapuato. So they want to maintain order at the contract distribution sites above all else. And they, state officials, make the determination that the best way to maintain order at the contract distribution sites, at the recruitment and selection sites, is to further decentralize the selection process. So to have aspiring braceros chosen by municipal governments, and in Mexico, a municipal government, it's roughly the equivalent of a county government here in the United States. And so state governments very quickly told their municipal counterparts, okay, like, you know, the state government received, let's say, for example, a state government receives 1,000 contracts from the federal government. And then the state government went to the municipal government and said, okay, well, we're going to give you 100 of those 1,000. You choose the 100 workers who get them, and then you just give them a card, and then they'll come to the contracting center and exchange the card for the contract. So the state governments wanted the aspiring braceros to be in the contracting center sites for as little time as possible to minimize the possibility of disturbances, to minimize the possibility of violence, like what had occurred in Mexico City. So they decentralize the selection process. And there are, and one of the curious things is that they really are fully committed to this. Even in years when the state government tries to give preference to specific workers. So for example, in the mid-1940s, there was a volcanic eruption in central Michoacán. This is the Paricutín volcanic eruption. Paricutín is a volcano. It's now extinct. It's in central Michoacán. This is south of the Bajío. So south of the Bajío, this significant volcanic eruption, the volcano continually erupted for approximately 9-10 years. So which led to farmland in the region being covered, by ash and by lava. And so there were a few years when the state government in Michoacán said, okay, well, we're going to set aside X number of contracts for people whose lands have been affected by the volcanic eruption. And so they would send the contracts, they would assign the contracts to that region, but then the state government wouldn't actually follow up to see if their instructions were being followed. And so they would make the allocation, but they're so afraid, they're so worried that they will suffer political blowback if they get involved, that they just, you know, send the contracts, don't follow up, even as they're getting reports that the contracts are not being given to folks who are impacted by the volcanic eruption. At about the same time, and this is in the Bajío itself, the Bajío in 1947 suffered from a foot and mouth disease outbreak, that affected the livestock population. And foot and mouth disease, this is a viral infection that affects, it can affect cattle, it can affect pigs, sheep, goats. It basically leads to fevers and blisters in infected animals. And animals who recover are permanently debilitated. So, for example, a dairy cow, if it's afflicted with foot and mouth disease, if it recovers, it no longer produces milk. Or if it does produce milk, it's nowhere near as much milk as it used to produce. So you have this outbreak in the Bajío in 1947, that's affecting the livestock population. And one of the policies that the federal government implements, to combat the outbreak is the immediate slaughter of infected animals. So to limit the outbreak, you immediately slaughter infected animals. Then to provide income to those who had been affected by the slaughter of their animals, the state governments of both Michoacán and Guanajuato set aside contracts for communities that had been affected by the outbreak, that had been truly affected by, or that had been heavily affected by the outbreak, excuse me. But again, neither Guanajuato's nor Michoacán state government actually follows up to make sure that its instructions are being followed, because their primary concern is minimize disturbances at the contract distribution sites, minimize the chance of political fallout that will affect us directly. And so, you know, again, local officials, they don't actually follow through. They don't actually give contracts to rural workers who had been affected by the foot and mouth disease outbreak. People do complain, but then the state governments say, well, we did our part. And Guanajuato's governor, in an address to the state legislature, said, well, you know, my efforts were, you know, undermined by, you know, callous local officials who disregarded the instructions. So not interfering, it saved state governments from political fallout, but also in instances of corruption, it gave state governments the rhetorical moral high ground. You know, governors could claim, well, we did our part. It's not, you know, my fault that our instructions weren't followed.
So in the middle chapters of this book, you shift focus to aspiring braceros and explore what it is that motivated them to seek these contracts. And among other factors that you've already mentioned, religious activism, religious movements are one of them. So can you talk to us a bit more about this relationship between the church and the state in these years and connect this to braceros?
Yes. So the five states that I examine in the book, Aguascalientes, Guanajuato, Jalisco, Michoacán, and then particularly the regions of those states that fall within the Bajío. And again, just to refresh everyone's memory, this is the contiguous lands of southern Guanajuato, northern Michoacán, northeastern Jalisco, southwestern Aguascalientes, and southern Zacatecas. This was the region where popular demand for contracts was highest. So the five states within Mexico, popular demand for contracts was highest in those five states. And within those five states, popular demand for contracts was highest within this region. About two-thirds of the nearly 3,000 written contract requests that I examined were from the Bajío. And one of the factors that influenced demand was the continuation of these religious political conflicts. So the Bajío, during the 1920s and the 1930s, was an epicenter of conservative Catholic resistance to revolutionary policies. So like anti-clerical policies, for example, policies that aim to limit the number of priests that could be active in jurisdictions, the revolutionary land redistribution, and the way that revolutionary land redistribution worked is that private estates were expropriated, they were divided into individual use parcels, and then agrarian reform beneficiaries received use rights, but not ownership of the parcels. So that was something that conservative Catholics opposed, and also they opposed secular public education. And one of the goals of the secular public education system of the 1920s and the 1930s, one of the stated goals was to, quote, defanaticize, end quote, Catholics. So those three policies drew a lot of opposition from conservative Catholics. And one of the reasons why the Bajío emerged as one of the epicenters was because the church's institutional presence in that region dated back to the colonial period. So it dated back to the colonial period through parishes, through convents, monasteries, missionary colleges. And the church was one of the few institutions in this region that survived the turmoil of the 19th century. So, you know, independence in the 19th century, in the early 19th century, excuse me, and then the liberal conservative civil wars of the middle decades of the 19th century. And so the church had a lot of institutional prestige in this region. It also had a lot of social prestige in this region as well. And the Catholicism that was and is practiced in the Bajío, it's a very Hispanic Catholicism. And what I mean by that is that unlike other regions of Mexico, like say, for example, the Valley of Mexico or Oaxaca, Chiapas, the Catholicism practice in the Bajío does not demonstrate as many overt signs of pre-Hispanic indigenous influences. The Bajío was a region that had that was not densely settled by indigenous peoples prior to the arrival of the Spanish in the 16th century. And so the Bajío was primarily settled by Spanish immigrants during the colonial period, but also by Hispanized indigenous converts. And so these are indigenous peoples, many of whom had been allies of the Spaniards during the fight against the Mexica, the Aztecs, who then converted to Catholicism and were then rewarded with lands in the Bajío for their services. So it's a very not entirely Hispanic, but it's a very Hispanic Catholicism, and a Catholicism that is very sensitive to the dictates of the Vatican, very sensitive to ultramontane Catholicism. And so as a result of that Hispanic Catholic tradition, in the late 19th, early 20th century, when social Catholicism emerged, and social Catholicism is a doctrine that acknowledges the ills of capitalist production. So it acknowledges that capitalist production leads to income inequality, that it leads to the abuse of workers by their employers. But social Catholicism rejects the Marxist argument that class conflict is what is needed to make more egalitarian society. Social Catholicism argues that cooperation between employers and workers and the respect for private property rights is what will lead to more harmonious and egalitarian societies. And so that really resonated in this region that was already sensitive to the dictates of the Vatican, but also in a region where small to mid-sized agricultural states known as ranchos were the predominant form of land tenure. So in some of these municipalities, in some Bajío municipalities, the ratio of ranchos, of small to mid-sized, of haciendas, of large estates, to ranchos, small to mid-sized estate, The ratio of ranchos, small to mid-sized estates, to haciendas, large estates, is something like 600-2. And so you have a lot of private property owners in this region. And so in the 1920s and the 1930s, when you have revolutionary governments who are moving against the church, but also moving against private property, that leads to conflict. That leads to the Cristero Wars of the 1920s and the 1930s. And then what I found is that those conflicts at the community level, they lingered on into the 1940s, the 1950s, and the 1960s.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So a term that's important to understanding these Mexican land reforms, which you've already talked about, in the post-revolutionary era, is the ejido and the related term ejidatario. And can you connect, maybe explain a little bit more about what these terms mean and connect them to the fact that many ejidatarios wanted to be braceros?
Yes. So ejido, in older Spanish, ejido just means the common use lands of a community. So a community's common use lands. In the context of revolutionary Mexico, an ejido is an agrarian reform community. So an ejido is a community that has benefited from the agrarian reform, that has received access to expropriated and redistributed lands. And ejidatarios were the rural workers, the campesinos, who received use rights to these lands. And so the way that it worked, and you know, during the 1910s, during the 1920s, there were many debates among revolutionary leaders, among revolutionary officials, as to what the best type of land redistribution or what the ideal for land redistribution should be. Should you just return lands to communities and let each community decide individually? Should you do a more 19th century liberal style agrarian reform, where you just break up large estates into small individually owned parcels? Do you aim for collectivization? There were revolutionary leaders, revolutionary officials who believed that collectivization was the key, that was how land redistribution should be pursued. Ultimately, all of those ideas influenced the adoption of the ejido as the most prevalent form of land redistribution in Mexico. So the way that it worked is that interested communities would petition for lands. After a community filed its petition, survey engineers would arrive to determine which of the nearby estates were eligible for expropriation. And small estates, usually estates that were small or that had fewer than 300 hectares, which I think is approximately 600 acres or so, those were generally exempt from expropriation. So survey engineers would go, they would survey the lands, and the lands that or communities were eligible to receive lands within a 7-kilometer radius. And that rule was put in place to make sure that the ejidatarios, the agrarian reform beneficiaries, wouldn't have to travel too far to reach their holdings. So the lands were surveyed. Once it was determined which lands were eligible for expropriation, an ejido's boundaries would be set. So its external boundaries, but also the internal boundaries of any of the individual use parcels, and also any livestock grazing or forest lands that would be dedicated for communal use. And then the size of individual use parcels was determined by whether or not they had access to irrigation water, or if they only had access to seasonal rainwater. And so, as I recall, if the parcel had access to seasonal rainwater, it could measure, I believe, 4 or 5 hectares. And then if it had access to irrigation water, 8 or so hectares. Those size limits then, that set a finite number of parcels. So it's not like the boundary or the external boundaries were set and then they asked, okay, well, how many people live in this community who are eligible to become ejidatarios? Oh, it's 50, so we'll divide this into 50 individual use parcels. But in that community, it's 200, so we'll divide it into 200 individual use parcels. No, the size of the parcels and the number of the parcels was determined by the quality of the lands, whether or not they had access to irrigation water, whether or not they had access to seasonal rainwater. And so what ends up happening is, with the 7-kilometer radius, that's it. Whatever is within 7 kilometers, that's what you have access to. But, you recall I said a few minutes ago that in the Bajío, the small to mid-size estates greatly outnumber the large estates. So there are haciendas that are eligible for expropriation, but there's also a significant number of properties that by law cannot be touched. And so already there are limits on the lands that can be expropriated. And then the rules that determine the size of the parcels places limits on that as well. So what ends up happening, particularly early on in the Bracero program, is that you see ejidatarios, or you see people who want to be braceros, who are eligible to be agrarian reform beneficiaries, they're eligible to be ejidatarios, but there are not enough parcels in their ejido to satisfy their needs. They were left out, and then the parcels were assigned by a random drawing. And so, you know, it was luck. If you're in a community where there are more ejidatarios than parcels, the luck of the draw quite literally determined if you were going to have access to the ejido's lands. And so you have a lot of people who are eligible to become ejidatarios who then, decide that they want to become braceros because, you know, the way that the rules are set, that they prevent them from accessing land. At the same time, you also have ejidatarios who are dealing with the fact that the lands that they've been assigned aren't very good lands. And particularly, a lot of ejidatarios who live in communities that either have, or that either only have, or the majority of their lands only have access to seasonal rainwater, well, if there are drought cycles, they're out of luck. There's nothing they can do. And so, yes, they've received lands, but the lands they've received aren't very good quality lands. And so during drought cycles, during down years, they decide that their best option, is migrating to the United States. But again, the quality of their lands or the lack of their lands, the reason that they are landless or are having to deal with low quality lands is because of the way that the land redistribution process was structured.
So moving back to the government officials, let's look now at the local, the municipal level. And you explain how these officials end up enjoying, you know, almost complete latitude over distributing bracero contracts. So how do they end up selecting the many people who might have a reason to want to migrate to the United States? What does that process look like on the ground?
It is a process that looks at, from the point of view of aspiring braceros, it's a process that looks very, very corrupt. Because both the federal and state governments, because they have little to no interest in exercising oversight, the municipal officials, the ones who are actually have the power to choose who will receive a contract, they have free rein. And without any threat of any sanction, any punishment for their malfeasance, their priority when they're distributing contracts is by and large, okay, how can this help me as a municipal official? How will this benefit me? And so you see financial corruption almost immediately. You see allegations that municipal officials are exchanging contracts for bribes. And by the time you get to the 1960s, some municipal officials are alleged to have pocketed hundreds of thousands of pesos worth of bribes from aspiring braceros. So you have, I guess, for lack of a better term, you have relatively straightforward corruption, but you have a politicized corruption as well. And here you see another political dimension of the bracero program is that many of these municipal officials, they're using local political considerations to determine who is going to get contracts or who is not. I'm going to give contracts to my local allies. I'm going to freeze my local rivals out of the bracero program. Something that will benefit me politically within just the local political context. And oftentimes those political considerations were wrapped up in those ongoing religious local political tensions. So, for example, in one community in Michoacán, in the community of Puruandiro, during the mid-1940s, conservative Catholic partisans who were affiliated with the Unión Nacional Sinarquista, the UNS, a conservative Catholic opposition and many members of the UNS were former cristeros, they formed an alliance with the local municipal president in Puruandiro. In fact, many members of the UNS won seats on the local ayuntamiento, the local municipal council. And so the municipal president, working with his allies in the UNS, declared that only members of the UNS will be allowed to migrate as braceros. Only UNS members will be given bracero contracts. And so if you wanted to be a bracero, you had to join the UNS. At least if you wanted to be a bracero from Puruandiro, you had to join the UNS. About 10 years, actually a few years after that, in 1952, and 1952 in Mexico was a presidential election year. In Irapuato, in Guanajuato, the municipal president there was a member of the ruling party, the Partido Revolucionario Institucional, the PRI. But that municipal president, in order to make sure that members of the UNS wouldn't be in Mexico during the election, wouldn't possibly interfere with the electoral process, that municipal president made sure that members of the UNS were given bracero contracts, but that was so that they would be out of the country during the presidential election. And in Mexico, presidential elections generally happen during the summer months, usually in June and July, which is, of course, when there is a lot of agricultural work being done in the United States. And so that municipal president, it was a calculated move to remove members of the UNS so that they wouldn't be able to interfere in the electoral process as well. And there's also, I also found evidence that this might have actually been part of a larger quid pro quo agreement that basically established a level of peace between local members of the UNS and the municipal government. But again, for these municipal officials, it's always, how is the bracero selection process going to benefit me, either financially or politically? Municipal presidents who actually took the genuine needs of their constituents who wanted to be braceros at hand, they seem to be the exception rather than the rule. There were some who wrote to state governments to ask for contracts, who seemed to genuinely care that, okay, you know, there was a flood in my community. The local maize harvest was washed out because of the flood. Please send us some contracts, or, you know, things of that nature. But municipal officials like that, they seem to be the exception. The rule for municipal officials is, how is this going to benefit me? And so in many instances, the folks who came to the U.S. as braceros, they came because they had paid a bribe for their contracts, or, you know, because it benefited their local municipal government politically to send them to the United States. And this political and financial corruption at the local level, it did influence undocumented migration during the years of the Bracero program, because there were Mexican workers who decided to migrate as undocumented workers. And for example, they decided to hire the services of a coyote. And coyote in Mexican Spanish is a term for somebody who helps get undocumented migrants across the border into the United States. There are Mexican workers who said, you know, paying a coyote was essentially the same as paying the municipal president. So, you know, we would rather go to a coyote, we would rather enter the U.S. as undocumented workers rather than deal with the municipal government.
This is a book that is very much rooted in Mexican history, both in terms of addressing some of the most important processes going on in the 20th century, but it's also very much participating in some of the most active historiographical debates of the last decade. Saying that, I also noticed that you reference Mexico-U.S. relations in this book, and I sense that the order that you've given, putting Mexico first, is intentional. So could you pinpoint for us what your work illuminates about the relationship between Mexico and the United States?
I think one of the things that it illuminates is, well, I do think that I think it reinforces something that other works. And so, for example, transnational works like the works of or works with a transnational focus, for example, the works of Deborah Cohen, Mireya Loza, I'm also thinking about the works of Alexandra Delano. So I think it reinforces that, particularly when it came to the bilateral negotiations between the United States and Mexico, whenever the terms of the agreement that authorized the Bracero program were renewed, the United States did often have the negotiating leverage. And oftentimes the United States did behave unilaterally in order to make sure that it secured provisions that it wanted to secure in the agreement. So I think it reinforces that as well. I think one of the things, though, that I contribute, and particularly in looking at the Mexico-U.S. relationship, and I think one of the things that I'm able to highlight more is that it's not, I mean, yes, the U.S. did often have the negotiation leverage during the negotiations. Yes, the U.S. did behave unilaterally, but at least in terms of the negotiations, Mexico wasn't a bystander. And many times, the Mexican government, when it made these concessions to unilateral pressure from the United States, Mexican officials knew that there was going to be some benefit for them as well. It was, in other words, one of the things that I found is that many times Mexican officials were willing to pay the price that the United States exacted because, okay, if this is the cost of doing business, this is the cost of doing business. So, it's not like a woe is me story or, the Mexican government just being pushed around. And so, for example, in 1954, the U.S. government launched a mass deportation campaign. This is something that I talk about in the book, and this is a deportation campaign. And I apologize because the campaign was named after a derogatory term that's often used to describe undocumented immigrants. But the name of the operation was Operation Wetback. I touch upon it briefly in the book. Scholars like May Nye and Adam Goodman have talked about this mass deportation campaign as well. And so it was a mass deportation campaign, 1954. It relied on workplace raids. It relied on publicity to pressure undocumented immigrants to leave the United States. The workplace raids largely focus on the agricultural regions of California and Texas, but it also focused in large cities like Los Angeles, Chicago, San Francisco. And it did lead to calamity. It led to several deaths of undocumented immigrants who were quite literally left in the desert and would die of sunstroke. But one of the things that I found is that at the time, the president of Mexico was Adolfo Ruiz Cortines. And in his address to the state legislature, he actually lauded the United States. He praised their measures because he said, this will reduce undocumented migration, and this will ensure that most of the Mexico-U.S. migration is channeled through the Bracero program. So yes, the U.S. was exacting unilateral pressure, but the Mexican government was often willing. That's one of the things that I find. The Mexican government was often willing to pay the price that the U.S. exacted in order to keep this authorized channel for migrants to leave Mexico to enter the United States. In order to keep that open, Mexico was more than willing to pay the price that the U.S. exacted.
Could you talk to us about how this work connects to issues going on in the present and maybe speak as well about what you're working on lately now that this book is out?
Yeah, I think, it connects to the present in a way only because this is such a unique moment in the history of Mexico-U.S. migration. The years of the Bracero program are the only years when there is a formal agreement. And I want to stress formal agreement because there have been a lot of informal arrangements between the Mexican and U.S. governments regarding migration. But this is the only time that there is a formal agreement that allows, that specifically favors Mexican workers to enter the United States. And so you know, when you think about particularly the policies of the last 20 years or so, if you go back to the Clinton administration, when you really do begin to see the militarization of the border, you do begin to see, a significant rise in the number of deportations, both voluntary, quote unquote, voluntary departures, but also, you know, deportations that followed a formal deportation hearing. You know, obviously that number continued through the George W. Bush administration, during the Obama administration as well. And then, you know, the recent Trump administration, and of course, Donald Trump's initial campaign promise was, you know, we're going to build a wall across the entirety of the U.S.-Mexico border, and the Mexican government is going to pay for it. So it is a much different moment. And so by the contrast, you can see, you know, how much has changed. But you also see similarities as well. I mean, I was just talking a few minutes ago that in the middle of the 1950s, you have a mass deportation campaign. The U.S. government organizes a mass deportation campaign to target undocumented workers. This is a mass deportation campaign that the Mexican government welcomed. You can see echoes with some of the agreements between the U.S. and Mexican government today. And I mean, the context is different because a lot of the discussion currently right now is about immigrants and refugees from Central America, from the Caribbean, from Northern South America, particularly Venezuela, but, you know, preventing their entry into the United States and with the cooperation of the Mexican government. And so, you know, so there are stark similarities, stark differences, but you see some stark similarities as well. And so, yes, the pace of militarization of the border, the pace of deportations of undocumented immigrants, that's something that really begins to accelerate during the Clinton administration. But, you know, the roots go back to the years of the Bracero program. So you see those differences and you see those similarities. And there's something else, and this is something that I touch upon in the conclusion of the book. Mexico's current president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, he is on record as saying that he would like to revive the Bracero program, or that he would like to revive an initiative similar to the Bracero program. So an agreement that would specifically favor Mexican workers who want to work in the United States on a seasonal basis. López Obrador has also said that he would, that it would probably be good to include Central American nations. And I think, I can't remember if he's explicitly said this, but I believe he's mostly referring to Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. But I'm not sure if he's ever explicitly said which Central American nations. But, you know, again, have this revived guest worker program. Although, you know, the Biden administration sort of, you know, signaled that, well, you know, we'll discuss it. But, like, there's been no genuine progress, or at least no genuine public progress. But, you know, this is something that, you know, Mexican governments still invoke. Like, the contemporary Mexican federal government still invokes this as a possible model to follow as we move, you know, as we're now, you know, we're now 80 plus years since the Bracero program began. And so, you know, you still see the echoes. And this is something that, you know, at least, again, publicly on record, the current Mexican federal administration would like to revive in some way, shape, or form. And so those echoes are there. And I think there is still relevance, very, very significant relevance to what we're seeing today in issues of migration, not just Mexico-U.S. migration, but Central America-U.S. migration, Caribbean-U.S. migration, South America-U.S. migration as well. Again, particularly if you look at how Mexico and the United States have been cooperating to limit entries into the United States. As for what I'm working on now, I'm kind of changing tracks a little bit. There is a part of me that's curious as to how the Bracero program, I do still have some curiosity as to how the Bracero program worked in other regions. I've particularly been interested in Oaxaca, or I have an interest maybe at some point in looking into how the Bracero program worked in Oaxaca, a state in southern Mexico, but also sent a significant number of braceros to the United States, and that began sending more immigrants to the U.S. In the late 20th and the early 21st centuries. But my next larger project, I'm beginning to look at social welfare policy and actually childhood development policy in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And actually, it did grow out of a source that I cite in the book. One of the sources I cite in the book, this is a request for contracts. It was sent by a woman from Michoacán, who was the director of the school breakfast program in her local community. And this is in the 1960s. And when I first read that document and it triggered a memory, because I remembered that my mom talked about how her younger siblings, when they were in school, that they took part in a school breakfast program that my maternal grandmother and my maternal great-grandmother helped prepare food for. And then, I see this, document, and this is, a woman, a local woman who's leading this program. And, it started getting me thinking. I'm like, oh, okay, so there's this school breakfast program. And, in this document that I cited, the director of the program in this community was a woman. My mother remembers that, her mother and her grandmother, played a big role in preparing breakfast for the school breakfast program in my family's hometown. And so, I started doing a little bit of digging through online newspaper databases. And I found that the school breakfast program, it began in 1959 in Mexico City. And so it begins in 1959 in Mexico City as a project that was directed by Eva Sámano de López Mateos, who was Mexico's first lady at the time. She was the wife of President Adolfo López Mateos. And then that school breakfast program went national in 1961, and not just in urban centers, but in rural areas as well, rural areas like the one where my family is originally from. And it did seem like women had a big role in administering this program. And then again, just searching through, online, newspapers that are available online. I haven't done much archival research since the pandemic began 3 years ago. But then another thing that I found is that in the 1970s, the agency that administered the school breakfast program was merged with another agency to form the Sistema Nacional de Desarrollo Integral de la Familia, the National System for Integral Family Development, or the SNDIF. It's usually just known as the DIF, but the DIF, and this is an initiative that provides assistance to low-income families with young children. And one of the hallmarks of this program is usually providing a box of staples like beans, rice, cooking oil, sugar, to families with low-income children. So this is a program that's still active today. And so this social service program survived the neoliberal reforms of the 1980s, of the 1990s, when Mexico's federal government reduced its spending on social services, yet this program survived. And so I'm very curious now as to, how this program started, a program that begins in the cities and then was exported into the Mexican countryside, a program that appears to have given women an opportunity to engage directly in local politics as local community leaders, and a program that is still not in the exact same way that it was in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, but a program that is still active even after the neoliberal reforms of the late 20th and early 21st century. So that's what I'm looking at now. And again, it all grew out of this one document that I cite in the book.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. So you've got at least one eager reader waiting for it. So today we've been speaking with Alberto Garcia about his book, Abandoning Their Beloved Land, The Politics of Bracero Migration in Mexico. Thank you so much for joining us today, Alberto.
Thank you, Rachel.